Hi, and welcome to the Bits and Trees podcast. I'm your host, Matt Machuga, and joining me today is the host, or one of the hosts of the Art of Product podcast, Ben Orenstein. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Could you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Totally. I am not very short.
This looks very true.
Yeah, that's just the angle I put my camera at. No, so about me, yeah, I'm a programmer slash software entrepreneur kind of person. So I spent a long time writing code for money, and now I am trying to write code to sell to other people for money. And so I have a bit of a hybrid situation now. I'm doing a little bit of development, but also a bunch of sales and marketing stuff for a new company that I am working on.
Can you walk us through a little bit of your history? You spent a long time at ThoughtBot, but was that your first position, or did you have other jobs before that as well?
I've had a long job history. So I ended up not graduating college. I got kicked out of college for academic deficiency. And so I had to start kind of at the bottom, at least for me, which was like bartender at the Olive Garden. So I've had quite an employment history, but I slowly worked my way into tech and up the tech stack, so to speak, to the point where I was doing development. So I feel like probably for your audience, the relevant stuff starts around my... just before ThoughtBot, I would say. So I got my first Ruby and Rails job, when was it? Maybe 2010, I guess I would say. And then joined ThoughtBot somewhere in 2012, probably. Mm-hmm. And spent about 6 to 7 years at ThoughtBot writing Ruby and Rails professionally. And during that time at ThoughtBot, I ended up starting inside the company with some other people, a little sort of sub-business of teaching other Ruby developers how to write better code.
What was that like switching from... I guess I should start off. So ThoughtBot does a lot of consulting for anybody who doesn't know that ahead of time. How was it transitioning from doing consulting work into more of the product and managerial portion of it?
It was awesome. I had been doing development for a while at that point, and I love coding. I loved it then. I still do. But I also love novelty. I like trying new things and trying hard things. And so moving over to the business side of things was very exciting for me because I was still development involved, but had also had sort of bitten off a brand new field and focus. And I always find that really interesting.
Great. So one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on today was to talk a little bit about pair programming. And I know that's it's a strong topic at ThoughtBot. At least it was from way back when I remember. And these days you're doing some other pair programming related things. So let's start off from how you got worked into pair programming. How did all that get kicked off?
So pair programming for me was really huge. It actually, I think, it had a huge impact on my career, maybe more than almost anything else I did. So when before ThoughtBot, I had a job at a place called Dana-Farber, which is a cancer hospital in Boston. And I had never worked in Ruby professionally before and actually didn't have very much development experience in general. And I spent maybe 70% of my time the first 6 to 9 months of that job sitting next to my boss, who was a much more experienced Ruby developer. And we just paired all the time. And I got so much out of that experience. Like, I don't think I've ever leveled up quite so fast at any other point in my career as when I was doing that every day. And so that experience to me is like, I have a post on my blog titled How to Improve as a Programmer. And the number one thing I have on there is ideally pair with more experienced developers. It's just about the highest bandwidth thing that I have discovered. And it makes sense. Like, as humans, we've been learning from each other in an apprentice-master kind of scenario configuration for such a long time. It just works really well. And so I was very happy to continue pursuing that and spreading the word about it. And I'm happy to be working on things that enable people to pair now.
Great. I have very similar experiences. Pairing with people, especially when learning a new language, has always been very helpful for me. And at Auth0, it's one of the things that we push for when you start on a new team. So on my team, the first 2 weeks, I have you pair up with another developer and you get to work on that area that you're trying to focus on. And with any business that has cruft, which is arguably all businesses, it really helps Sure. kind of teach those domain differences, the nuances of each team's culture. So like whatever style guide they want to follow, all that. It just seems to help overall. And I really enjoy watching people learn that way. So can you list off some of the pros of pair programming?
So I think the biggest thing is the knowledge transfer. So there's the bandwidth between two people while they're working is much higher than almost any other configuration that I'm aware of. So I'm not just talking knowledge transfer, like, oh, what are, like, how does our system work? It's how does our system work? But it's also how do we work as a team? What does the review process look like? What kind of standards do we hold ourselves to? How big are our PRs? How nice are people to each other? How do you request reviews when you need help? There's just so many little things about working and that show up in a pairing session. And beyond that as well. So when I was pairing with my boss every day, I learned so many good workflow things from him. Where it's like, okay, he's a Vim user and he knows what's up. And like, so I'm learning Vim tricks. I'm learning shell things. I'm learning just about all the mechanics that go into programming that eventually can make you go faster and make things go more smoothly. I think the number one thing above all is just the fact that you can learn so much from each other. And it's not even a flow of experience to less experience. If you take two people that are both newbies or two people that are both experts or any combination of those, you will find that knowledge flows in both directions all the time because mm-hmm. everyone knows different things about different things. So you might be an expert on this particular niche and I might be an expert in another, and we can level each other up in our various different niches.
Yep, very true. So one of the biggest complaints I hear about pair programming, and one of the ones that I feel myself, is that it's easy to get fatigued over time. Have you ever experienced that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some truth to this, and there's also some maybe a little bit of confusion, I guess. So yes, I think pairing is a bit more draining than programming solo because there's a higher communication requirement. And you're thinking about and considering another person while you're doing it. So it takes a little bit more horsepower. But also, I think people tend to find pairing draining because it actually keeps them on task. Mm-hmm. And people are not actually used to working for most of the day.
Yeah, I think the most recent reports I've seen show that people were actually productive from between 2 to 4 hours of work. And the rest of the time, yep. It was kind of chasing themselves around.
Totally. And those 2 to 4 hours are probably split up by like frequent, like, let me pop over to Twitter. Let me read my email. Let me get up and go do this thing for a little bit. And pairing shuts down a lot of those, or at least curtails a number of them. And so I think there's an extent to which people find pairing tiring because they have never really done extended deep work, or they do it rarely, and they're not used to what it feels like to focus for that long.
Right. How do you find it to get back on track after taking a little bit longer of a task, like maybe a build or running a test suite? How do you get the pair back on track during that period?
I don't know that I have any particular tricks or tips around that. What I've generally found is just the fact that the two of you are there together and you know that the goal is to accomplish something and to be working. The getting on task and staying on tasks tends to kind of happen fairly organically. Like, I don't enter a pairing session thinking like, all right, I got to make sure that we stay focused on this. There's just, I think, a little bit of subtle, passive social pressure happening where it's like, well, we're both here and we're both getting paid and we know we should be working. And so the two of us working together means that more of the time we will end up just doing the right thing and focusing.
Right. One of the things that I've personally struggled with is I care deeply about the person aspect of programming. So we'll get into it. And it'll be very serious for an extended period of work. And then you run that integration suite where you have to wait 5 minutes. So then you start getting into a discussion. Well, like, oh, how are things going with your family? How was your last performance review? How'd all this go? And then mm-hmm. you have to try to get it back on track when the test suite's done. And sometimes that's gone over. So I try to either set a timer to remind myself or just do something where it can't go past this limit because now you're getting into personal time.
I like that. I think that's good. One thing I've had good success with is Pomodoros. Mm-hmm. So working for a certain period of time and then breaking for a set period of time. And like there are lots of little programs that will sort of remind you, hey, it's time for the break. Hey, it's time to get back. And so if you can plan your slow things like integration tests and whatnot for those breaks, that would be ideal. But also when I hear like, oh, there's certain things that we do during the day that necessitate us stopping for a while, that is a little bit of a smell to me. Where it's like, okay, yeah, it's hard to have a really great integration test suite that doesn't take a little while, but is there some subset of those tests you could run instead until you're at a better stopping point to sort of keep you a little bit more in flow? Would mm-hmm. be something I would want to ask myself.
Yeah, so a lot of these questions are probably answered in this pairing guide that you've released recently. Can you talk to me a little bit about how that whole thing came about and what kind of content we can find in it?
Totally. Yeah. So I'm working on a company and we are making a tool to allow people to do remote pair programming. And so my job, so there's three of us and we're all programmers, but I ended up with the sort of marketing and sales responsibilities for this. And so I asked myself, like, what is the thing I can do that will let people bump into us and know we know what's up, but also is a good thing for the world? I don't just want to make like sort of clickbaity blog posts or like kind of trick people into giving us their attention. I want to make a useful, durable artifact that will make the world better, regardless of whether it brings us customers. And so that pairing guide is hopefully going to be that. So I started a thing called the Tuple Pairing Guide, and I've been steadily adding to it and just putting everything I know about pair programming up there for free, and hopefully nicely organized and with a nice design. And it's a home for, it's getting closer and closer to what I would say is sort of like roughly content complete, but I actually want it to be, I want it to literally be the best pair programming resource on the internet. And I think that's an achievable goal because there isn't that much out there. Like if you Google like pair programming guide or tutorial or whatever, it's mostly Medium posts, which will surely disappear from the internet when Medium's business model fails. A couple of years from now, people listening to this podcast will find nothing but broken links for that. So I think I can kick the ass of a Medium blog post, and that's my goal. I want it to be really good and really comprehensive and stand the test of time.
What kind of differences do you find between remote pair programming and local pair programming?
I wish remote pair programming were as good as local pairing. I don't think there's anything quite as good as sharing the computer sitting next to each other. But the reality is that's not always an option. Remote work is more and more common, and I think that's net probably good for the world. And so I want it to be as close to, ideally remote pairing is like local pairing, but there are a couple places where it differs and will suffer a little bit. One is just that I can't see you as well. I can't feel your body language. I can't tell quite when you're confused as well as I could if you were sitting next to me. And there's also the sort of keyboard handoff thing, where if you and I are sitting next to each other and I see you reach your hands out to the keyboard, I can tell you want to type something and I can take my hands off, and there's not much of an explicit handoff required. But with remote, that's a little trickier. And so it's I guess the when you're pairing remotely, the thing you have to think about more is it's even more of a communication process than sitting next to each other. There's like there are fewer things to stand in for speaking when you're remote.
I'm very hopeful that Tuple comes up as the best thing since Screen Hero. I try not to say anything like too flame baity, but I will say that Slack broke the internet when they discontinued Screen Hero. I've worked remotely for 6 years, and at Auth0 we're entirely remote for the most part. So when that feature is not available, trying to cope with like, okay, Zoom, you can share the controls, but it's a little spotty. Slack, you can share most things. It still has a few weird oddball things that pop up. And Screen Hero just worked. Is Tuple going to be the solution for us?
Man, I hope so. It's a hard technical problem. Like, there are smart people working hard on Zoom and Slack, and they would love it to be perfect. And the whole Screen Hero just worked thing was the result of tons of work. It's not like, oh, like everyone else is just doing the stupid thing and they should have just done the smart thing and had it just work perfectly all the time. The reality is it's a hard technical problem, but I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic. So Slack calls and Zoom screen sharing, whatever they call it, are small features inside a larger product. And so I don't think they're going to get the attention that they necessarily deserve. And so our hope is that by making our tool just for remote pair programming and nothing else, that we can be really insanely obsessed about things in a way that other people won't be, and we can eventually make it be that thing that just works. So fingers crossed, I hope we can do it. It's the hardest thing I've tried to do technically in a long time. My other companies have been, or the other businesses I've worked on have been much lower technical risk. This one has a much higher technical risk. But I think the early indications, what I'm seeing with like the alpha that we're working on and the people I'm talking to, I think we can get there.
Do you have a strategy for what the MVP is going to include?
So we're shaking that out a little bit still. So the current thing we're working on is getting an alpha to a group of people who have prepaid to get alpha access. And so we're still kind of, we have some things that we know are definitely going to be in it and some things that we know definitely won't be in it. But there is a bit of a gray area where it's like how much goes into it. The tricky bit is, so we know you need keyboard, like two people need to have keyboards and mice. That's important. I need to be able to see your screen and talk to you. Those are essential. Nothing makes sense without that. But then it's like, how do you actually do multi-mouse well? Mm-hmm. That is probably a problem that takes 9 months to solve, believe it or not. Like, the operating system believes in one mouse pointer and one mouse pointer only. And so to have two mice is sort of a hack by definition. Mm-hmm. There's no way to make it not a hack. And so the way you handle the tricky edge cases makes a huge difference in how it feels to actually use. And so, like, that's just like one thorny problem. There's another thorny problem of, like, this is real time over the internet and latency matters a ton. So if I'm typing on a remote machine and it takes 400 milliseconds to see the results of my keystrokes, I'm going to make way more typos and it's going to be really annoying to type on. And so it has to be really fast and low latency. And that in itself is like a huge hard problem. So the alpha to us is like, we can get all of these things to like an okay level. But what's the degree to which, how often do they have to be? And how awesome can we make them before we start putting them out there and getting feedback? Because if we release something that has high latency and everyone goes, it has high latency, it's like, well, yeah, we know that sucks. We want to make that better too. So it's hard to know what's a reasonable amount of latency to give to our alpha users. Well, like, we'll see. So I wouldn't say we have a strategy. We're figuring it out. We're kind of bumbling around and trying to do our best.
I can only imagine trying to work through a backlog on that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's tricky for sure.
So going back to, I guess, just generic pair programming concepts for a little bit, can you tell us about how you might handle a situation where you and your pair, you're not quite gelling? You don't really seem to think up. There might be an internal conflict, or maybe it's just the way you work. How does that kind of situation pop up, and how can you smell that sort of thing beginning to happen?
So I haven't had a ton of experience with that, honestly. Most of the time, I have mostly found a way to work with people. But I sometimes will notice that it's not a great time for me to pair. It's not the person. It's just that, like, it's where I'm at that moment. Sometimes I'm hungry or tired or bored or distracted. And the cues I notice in myself to start paying attention to are frustration is the biggest one. Like, when I'm tempted to dismiss someone's idea or like kind of get snippy with them or like say like just like I just want them to stop talking so I can just code this thing, mm-hmm. That's when I start to think like, okay, I probably need a break or a nap or a snack or something. Like, I need to change something about what's going on right now. If I imagine there are some combinations of people that just will never be able to pair well together, and so I would encourage people to, if you feel like you're in that situation, I would first encourage people to give it an honest shot, because I think most people can figure out a way to like work together civilly. But if you really can't, then maybe just accept that. Like, pairing is not a panacea. It's okay if you don't do it. If there are people that don't enjoy pairing together after giving it a fair shake, I think that's pretty reasonable to just sort of talk about honestly and say, it seems like we just like our working styles are maybe not quite well suited for each other. So maybe we just shouldn't pair. Like, just don't force it. That seems pretty reasonable to me.
So you brought up some really great insights there. And for whatever reason, it triggered in my head. What happens if you don't use the same editor? How does that go over?
You know, I've been fortunate enough to mostly avoid this. Like, I did a lot of pairing in Thoughtbot, and almost everyone used Vim. So that was pretty nice for me. But I think if you don't use the same editor, that's okay. So one thing to realize is that programming is not all about typing speed. It's not all about how fast you're slinging code around and like massaging it and doing surgery on it. And so I'm at my fastest writing code in Vim, but I probably end up with much better code when pairing with somebody, regardless of what editor we use. So to me, it's okay to accept a bit of a code editing productivity hit in return for the quality benefit and all that knowledge transfer and sharing and the goodness that we talked about before that you get out of a pairing session. So to me, it kind of doesn't matter. It's like, yeah, I use different editors. I'm not as fast with Sublime as you are. I'm going to be typing, or like, I'll go slower than usual. That's probably just fine, actually.
Mm-hmm. I've I think when I first started, it annoyed me a little bit. And then I really grew to like not having somebody who would use a different editor. So I was always in Vim or Emacs with the Space Max or Evil configuration. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of colleagues who would use Sublime Text. And every time the multi-cursor would kick off, it would blow my mind. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm used to editing columnar, and that would be great. And then they're, you know, tabbing all over the screen, picking up new elements. And all of a sudden, everything's edited. So I got to see a new way of editing from that. Or some people would use, I think it's called GitK or GitX or something. It's the UI that Git ships with. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen that thing before. And one of my colleagues lived off it for doing diffs. So that was a really interesting thing for me to pick up from them. And, totally. You know, way to get into the occasional, like, I can't edit on your screen. Like, can you do the keystroke to do this? Because I can't figure it out. And at that point, it forces more discussion, more collaboration. I didn't find it to be too much of a time sink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good to hear. That matches my intuition around that.
Yeah, it was kind of nice. Yeah. I miss doing that more. It seems like a lot of people on my team settle on VS Code these days. And then there's still two or three of us who are on Vim. So you get a nice mix back and forth.
Mm-hmm. That's healthy, I think. It's good to see like what else is out there, like the multi-cursor thing, for example. There are times where you see someone else do something like, oh, that makes me a little jealous. Maybe I should think about, is it worth switching editors? Is there a plugin I should look for? Is there a way I can like replicate that workflow in my own setup?
So tooling might derail us from the pair programming concept here. But now that you're working with, I think you said you're in Xcode now, right? Because it's a Mac app.
Yes.
Okay. So. For Rails development, I would always rely on Pry. I never really got into using any of the Rails debuggers. I just like throwing Pry in there and then kind of working through that way. In Auth0, we're using a whole lot of JavaScript, and I still just tend to use puts debugging. Like, I'll put a console log somewhere and sort through it like that. One of the engineers on my team figured out how to throw the VS Code into all of our configurations, the VS Code debugger integration. So he quite happily like executes the code, runs the test suite. He has a breakpoint set up somewhere, and then he just steps through the code in his editor while he's working on it. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing was really great to learn. How do you feel in an environment where the debugger is kind of the first class citizen now rather than an afterthought?
Unfortunately, I'm probably the wrong person to ask this. So I did a little bit of development on our app, but I actually have moved mostly over to marketing efforts these days. We have three programmers, and the point was made, like, you know, having everyone work on the code is probably an over-concentration of resources and a classic failure mode for the developer-led startup. Mm-hmm. So let's avoid that. So I spent a little time in Xcode, but not enough to really form fair opinions of it. So I'm the wrong guy, I think.
Got it. Well, how are you handling working in marketing world then?
I miss programming a little bit, I'll admit. It is nice that some of the things I've been doing are like somewhat technical, like building this pairing guide. I did the design myself and was, you know, getting my level of my CSS skills past embarrassing to like now just like somewhat embarrassing.
Yeah, nice.
So that satisfies some of that. I find it a little bit harder to get into a flow state as when I'm programming. It's easier for me to start coding and have a lot of time go by. It's harder for marketing efforts, although writing a nice long article for the guide kind of gets me close. So it's fine. I don't love it quite as much as other things, but I think it's what the business needs. And I love having a business, and I want the business to succeed. And so I'm willing to do this if this is what it takes.
So you and Derek go back and forth a lot on the art of product, and you give updates on how the process is working out, how each of you are changing things up. Is that kind of environment like helpful for you? Do you enjoy having that kind of mastermind feel? Do you like hearing about his technical problems, his business problems? How does all that work out? Because it's kind of like pair programming without the programming portion.
Yeah, totally. That's an interesting insight. Yes, I love it. So there are a few things that are quite as fun as telling someone else how to solve their problems. Because it's just everything from the outside is so simple. Mm-hmm. And like so clear, and you're like, oh, this advice is amazing, this will definitely work. And so it's like very tantalizing to have someone be like, oh, I'm having this problem. You're like, oh, just XYZ, duh. It's fun. It feels good. And so I would enjoy it almost regardless, even if we weren't recording it. I think it would be a fun process just to have like a mastermindy type thing. But also it's really useful. So like talking to, like, Derek is a smart person with a lot of experience. And one of the things, I don't do a lot of prep for our podcast, but I do try to jot down a couple of questions for him. And getting to get his feedback on things, and also just the other friends I have that are involved in this space, has been so useful for me. Like, all of the things I've made in the last few years are better because of the smart people I've been able to talk to about them. Sometimes, like, dramatically better. Sometimes my version one, I'll send to somebody and they're just like, this is not very good. Like, you need to change this a lot. And I love that. Like, that's the spice of life to me. I like getting better at things. Mm-hmm. So it's, yes, having a podcast with a smart person and talking to them is awesome.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You guys have paired together on his application level, right?
Correct. Yep.
Is that like an ongoing thing, or just kind of get in there once? How'd that work out?
We did it, I think, twice. Once we recorded it and once it was just us.
How was that working in an environment where, I'm assuming you've not done Elixir? Maybe you have. I shouldn't be so presumptuous. Mm-hmm. Is that a new environment for you?
Yes. It was all new. So it was, his tech stack is Elixir, Phoenix, Elm, and GraphQL. And I have done a bit of Elm, and that's about it. So the rest of it was new to me. And actually, you can watch our pairing session. We recorded one of them on the pairing guide. So that's one of the things that's on there. And so you can see what it's like for me to be in a new environment. And it's fun. I dig it. So I took more of a navigator role, which makes sense. But along the way, I just get to ask lots of questions and be like, oh, is this like this thing from that other thing? And it's a really nice way to get leveled up in some new technologies. Because it's not like I was reading a tutorial of like, how do you make a Phoenix app? That's nice and sort of systematic, but seeing someone else's working code and having them call out the most important parts and bump into the things that you actually need to know is a really efficient way to get up to speed on something, in my experience.
Right. So you've been podcasting for at least 4 or 5 years now, right?
That's right.
How has that gone? There's been quite an evolution over time. Like, I used to listen to a lot of the Giant Robots podcast, still do with different hosts. And then that kind of transitioned formats a couple times, right?
It did, yes. So it started off as an interview show, and then it became more of the mastermind format that I use now on Art of Product as well, where it's me and someone else talking about what we're working on and our challenges.
Yeah. What do you think your favorite style so far has been?
I think the mastermind thing is great. It's, like I said, it's nice to ask smart people questions and get their feedback. It's also pretty easy. I'm always telling people they should start podcasts because they are fairly low effort compared to other similar activities. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something that's a person that listens to your podcast regularly has a personal connection to you in a way that they don't if they read your blog regularly. I think there's something about voices that I think is really powerful. So you can build these pretty strong connections in a completely scalable way. You can have an audience of 100,000 takes no more work than an audience of one. And there's outsourced editing companies, which is what we use. We use a company called Podcast Motor. And so Derek and I literally just record, drop our things in a Dropbox, and then they handle all the other stuff, show notes and editing and that. And it's just wonderful. So it's like an hour a week of my time. And we have a lot of people that are like, know our story and are kind of invested in it and are rooting for us. And I've gotten a lot of positive benefit out of having a podcast audience. And it's way disproportionate to the amount of work it takes week to week, honestly.
I gotta say, from doing screencasts a lot in the past and then doing podcasts, it's maybe a tenth of the work.
Yeah. Oh, screencasts are video is brutal. It's so much harder.
It's so bad. It's like, a great feeling when you get it out there. But, you know, if you make one mistake halfway through and it's a sequential video, you got to go back to the beginning.
I've made a number of video courses and screencasts and things. And I find that for me, a minute of video, like the ratio is something like 10 to 1. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, if I wanted to make a 1 hour like video course, that's it. Like, it's probably more than 10 to 1. It's probably way more than that. I mean, like, an hour video course is probably 100 hours of work or something. Total, like, editing, takes, all the stuff. It's crazy.
Yep. Yeah. Adam Wathen, who was a guest, I think he was on the second podcast, he would always keep up to date with me, like, you know, oh, I've been working on this series and this is taking me forever, like trying to get through this what would you call him, like a module in his TDD for Laravel course.
Yeah,
and he put in so much effort in that thing and it came out so well, but he did say he approached that the wrong way.
He and I talk about that a lot, where it's tough to so I was talking about making a course where I built an app, like a SaaS app, and like show how I do it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, do you have an idea of like what you'll actually talk about? And I was like, no, I was just planning on kind of showing my whole process. He's like, that's cool. I did that. It took me 500 hours of recording to get this course done. I was like, yeah, that's fair.
Did you change course after that?
Yes. There's some new ideas percolating. More on that later.
Very nice. All right. Are there any things that I neglected to ask you that you'd like to bring up?
Everyone should try to get more sleep.
I agree with this. This sounds brilliant.
Stretch more. Keep in mind that like having a desk job is like an active assault on your body every day. And if you want to be able to program most of the day and not feel like crap, you have to counteract the crap that we're doing to ourselves and stretch and move around and exercise and all that. So, you know, stand up sometimes.
Standing up is great. I have a standing desk back there.
Nice.
So I try to use that most of the day.
I've been standing this whole time. You can probably hear it in my voice.
I am being lazy right now. I am enjoying a nice kneeling chair, which is somewhat ergonomic, right? So I'll bring up one more thing. It's a little annoying to your pair if they can hear it, but I have a Kinesis Advantage keyboard, and it's very clacky. But man, that saves my wrists greatly.
Same. Yeah, I love that. I've had some RSI flare-ups over the years. That keyboard made a big difference for me. And the biggest thing is that it gets, for me personally, is that it gets the keys like delete and shift and control and all that off of your pinkies and onto your thumbs.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that kind of whatever that motion's called, where like you like rotate your hand to the outside and bring your pinky in, that is what always aggravated my joints and such the most. And so getting away from that movement made a huge difference. So if you're struggling with any of that, don't wait, because it can get worse over time, and B, check out the Kinesis.
I will second both of those. Waiting is a mistake. Have you ever done the macros on the Kinesis?
Mm-mm, no, never got that far.
So for the common moves like escape, I have escape mapped to one of them in the middle.
Uh-huh.
And then I also map what the key sequence on a Mac is command shift bracket either direction. So it like switches tabs on most Mac applications. Mm-hmm. I have that mapped to page up and page down. So it's like one less key chord that I have to hold, and it makes a whole world of difference.
Nice. I like that. Yeah, the key chords are dangerous. That's like, that was one of the big things that took me away from Emacs, honestly, was it aggravated my RSI real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yes, I could rebind some stuff or use evil mode or whatnot, but it was just like, I'm going to stick with Vim. It makes my hands feel better.
Okay. So if anybody's trying to follow along, where best can they do that?
So I have the podcast. It's called The Art of Product. You can also, if you want my even more hot takes and programming tips and tales in the trenches, my Twitter is pretty good. I'm R00K there.
Very good. And let's see, is there a Twitter set up for Tuple App or just the website right now?
There technically is. It has one tweet that says, hello world.
Ah, nice.
And it is pair with Tuple. If you want to follow that account that tweets nothing, or if you just go to tuple.app, we have a mailing list that I send stuff to semi-regularly. And you can go there and you'll hear about all the important things that are happening.
Perfect. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I think the information was great. And awesome. I hope people learn a lot from it.
Me too. My pleasure. I love guesting on podcasts.
Excellent. Take care.
Take care.